Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mian Team.
QNL.
With guest co-host
Jonah Falcon.
And the recording software is happy.
Excellent.
I will spare everyone the technical support details, as tempted as I am, for another time.
You can tell us after the show. Welcome, listeners. I'm the Mian Team. This is Polycast episode 118. I am joined by Daniel Quick.
If you face a book, will it book your face?
Makalua, who is getting caffeine, I assure you. QNL, who is also going to be joining us, and also guest co-host Jonah Falcon. Excellent.
Becky, who cannot find the unmute button.
There we go.
I actually told Dan I was about to do something to his face for that comment.
Just weighted probability with Mackie, you have to understand, listeners. It's about 60% getting caffeine and about 40% still microphone muted. So I was going odds on, but I guessed wrongly. I apologize. But I'll try to get it right for you next time.
I thought I'd warped Mackie's brain with my quote there for a moment, so.
You're about to warp something. You're about to see something warped. Maybe that's it.
Civilization World, preview with basics, and interview with Sid Meier. As we know, this used to be called Civilization Network until it was changed last year. And what is interesting about what's been posted on IGN UK is not so much the quote-unquote formal preview, but I actually like the fact sheet a little more because it's in the form of Q&A. And it even has a little bit of humor associated with it. So it's telling us, first off, that we can expect Civ World to be in an open beta this summer. It's currently in closed alpha testing right now, which obviously some people at IGN UK have access to. The alpha version includes the following civilizations: African, American, Arabian, Chinese, German, Grecian, Greek, assuming, Indian, Mongolian, Russian, and Spanish. Unlike the traditional Civilization series, there are no particular benefits automatically associated with each civilization. So no unique units, no unique buildings, no leader traits. So then this fact sheet says, so what is a civilization good for then? What's a civilization good for? Absolutely nothing.
Nothing.
No, what it is, and this also gets into the article on CNN with Sid Meier about the social aspect behind Facebook gaming, where civilizations are essentially the teams in Civ World where you and your fellow civilians can work together to advance through the ages and attempt to beat all the other civilizations. Players are ranked according to how much they're contributing, and members with higher ranks gain more privileges, although what those privileges are have not yet been defined. Civilizations are limited to one city, so this is very much about a vertical empire to see just how large you can grow your city. It kind of reminds me of the cell phone game Civilization IV, War of Two Cities, where it's just two cities, but where that game is focused on war, this has more than just combat. But there is indeed combat in this game. Civilizations can vote whether to attack another. Once war has been declared, each civilization has a certain window of time to stock up their military resources. In Civ World, it's with several hours. And then the battle plays out automatically. Okay. Losing civilizations lose their military units, while winners get any science and technology benefits that the other civilization has earned.
Oh, man.
Whoa. Okay.
This brings back memories, but it might not be for the best.
Although, given that the focus of Civ World is in the sense like Civilization Revolution, which is to get to some more casual gamers, to me this is like the casual gamer for Facebook. Not saying that people who enjoy the PC version and the console version can't get an aspect out of Civ World that they are can't get otherwise. I've compared once, actually more than once before, and liking the analogy of Civilization on the PC as chess, Civilization Revolution as checkers, and then this is, I don't know, Go Fish? I don't know.
Go Fish.
I don't know. And that's not, I'm not to be disparaging or anything like that, but I'm also saying, you know, as I'm reading this, I myself am not particularly interested in trying it, but as some of the comments have been, like, a lot of people have been quite negative about this, and they're saying, now, just a moment, give it a chance, play it first, and then pass judgment, you know, like you do on people do on Civilization 4 and Civilization 5. Fair enough. But I have to say, you know, I'm reading this, and, you know, you've got, like, an eyebrow level, you know, it's kind of level, and you're reading it, and it's like, uh-huh, it's like, Civilizations give you no particular benefits, one eyebrow gets raised, I'm interested, but then winners get any science and technology benefits that the other civilization has earned. Both eyebrows are now up. I'm waiting for the eyes to bug out of my face as I continue to read. They talk about an in-game marketplace where you can buy and sell resources. Market pricing fluctuates in real time according to supply and demand, so enterprising players can earn additional money by playing the system.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Now my eyes are bulged out of my head, and I'm trying to get them back in.
Dan is no fun. That's what that is.
I'm going to short sale people. I can't wait.
Exactly. Come on. That was the most fun part of World of Warcraft when I played it for a little while. Watch me completely screw over this market by buying everything up and then rebring, then selling it for more.
There's some neat things you could do that I never thought of that might have made that more fun for me, but I never played World of Warcraft, I'm afraid.
I got dragged into it. Stupid friends.
You're going to get a bunch of so-and-so wants to add you for this game, I'm sure. Especially you.
If you look for Dan Q on Facebook right now, they are all imposters. They are all cheap imitations of me. I do not have a Facebook account. Okay.
But what do you mean cheap? They spent a lot of time and effort making those Facebook profiles, you know. But I don't know about you, but this seems like a, I don't know, this seems like something that I would want to play at least.
The article says, if you know how Facebook games work, you're probably thinking about how premium currency fits into the equation, and if it's possible to, quote-unquote, buy your way to victory. As an aside, premium currency has not yet been defined specifically. So 2K, the publishers behind Civ, say that the developers, Firaxis, are still tweaking and balancing, but the current plan is to limit what you can spend premium currency on and how much you can spend a day. Their goal is to have the same fun and fair experience for the player that plays for free as the ones who pay. Now, I guess the question then becomes to me, and I think we've talked about this before about general games as well, is what you can spend on and how much in a day, are these things you're buying more aesthetic or are they more practical? Because if it says you have the same fun and fair experience for the pay-for players as well as the free players, then I expect that as soon as you research ironworking, for example, and you have $100, you couldn't buy 10 swordsmen for $10 a pop. And I'm completely pulling those numbers out of somewhere. So
everything comes from somewhere.
Maybe that thought has been influenced by the mini games that are discussed. And the mini-games have me thinking about, for instance, and I didn't play that much of Cult of Power, but as I recall, when it came to combat, you had to, like, a mini-game within the game where you played out combat in this kind of real-time mode. But there's, like, a mini-game for science and culture and money.
I don't know. I can see that this would be, this would be a good way for me, for example, to get some friends into Civ. But I don't know. I feel a little perturbed about this whole, or not perturbed, but disturbed, how about that, about this whole, you know, giving money for, well, Civ money idea. I don't know if that's actually going to be the case, but I'm thinking it will because most pricing models for Facebook go out that way with Facebook credits. Yeah, those lovely Facebook credits that you see at the grocery store all the time nowadays.
I know. I saw those the other day. I was like, what?
Well, I've managed to completely miss those. I'm glad of that, too. There are some things about this game I like. For example, they're not trying to do anything wonky in terms of balance between the civilizations, although I'm not sure what the African civilization represents, or the Grecian. Need to work on that, but Grecian.
I thought it was Grecian. Maybe it's Grecian.
At least balanced, so that's good. Yeah, I do have some concerns along the lines of Q&L with the pay-for-play model, especially if you can get a huge advantage by spending money. Obviously, there's always going to be someone out there who will do it, and then that kind of ruins the experience for other people. So hopefully that doesn't happen. And hopefully there's actually a competitive sense in this game, because most Facebook games I've seen do not really have that. It turns into a popularity contest. So we'll see what they actually do, or if they get corrupted by Facebook. But if Firaxis does get corrupted by Facebook, I won't blame them too much, because pretty much everything I've seen on there, with very few exceptions, has been corrupted by Facebook. So there you have it.
Firaxis and 2K, they need some kind of income model. And we know, as lucrative as online advertising is, but it's kind of like you answered this question and then you raise like two or three more questions for which we don't have an answer. But I think that's pretty much similar for any preview of a game, especially, I mean, this is the first preview that we've really seen talking about any specifics of the game since it was first announced publicly, what, last fall?
Yep.
Or last summer, maybe? Mm.
Who knows?
It lasts so long.
Time flies when you don't have a lot of new information to digest.
Yes.
It's emphasized that, unlike a lot of other Facebook games, Civ World has an end. There's a defined beginning and a defined end, where from the basics it says a game ends when one civilization wins the final age. Which,
so it's a default time victory, basically.
That's not funny, Lisa.
Well, you said you're not really good.
The victory condition,
anyway,
nobody ever wins, ever.
Unless you're deliberately trying to.
Yeah.
It also says that as of the alpha, players could play in up to 3 games at a time, and according to the preview article, each game of Civ World can have up to 200 players.
Hmm.
Whoa, that's a lot of players.
I predict crashes.
Yeah, Firaxis, Netcode.
Crashes in a new Civ release? No way.
Yeah, way. Facebook crashes and the productivity of the world goes up 100%.
In particular, like, I don't hate Facebook, but man, it's so overused.
Our guest co-host has joined us. Hello, Jonah.
Hey there. You know, Skype decided it wanted to do an update without my permission.
Oh.
Yeah, it's Skype. No bits.
You missed the funsies we had with Skype earlier as a result of that.
It's okay.
I don't mind a finite version of Civilization. I mean, it depends on how they implement it.
And yes.
To be fair, I've been more paying attention to Age of Empires Online. That's a little more intriguing to me, because I've seen Civ-type games that were on Facebook.
Yeah, I don't know how similar this will be compared to other Facebook games. I mean, I do know that, you know, Sid himself is involved. Sid himself is involved. And seems like he's done a relatively good job. I don't know how hard the Facebook API is to understand, but I would definitely try to play it at least once or twice.
Well, it's a lot easier to do it on Facebook since it is turn-based. So in Facebook, it does turn-based games better than any other games, even those like Farmville and stuff like that. Because if you have, you know, just resolve a turn and you send a Facebook notification to everybody saying, hey, this turn is over, you can do your next moves now. Sort of like a We Go version of Civ, rather than, you know, I go, you go.
You know, I think that any things that you would get from actually spending money on the game would probably be banned from whatever Hall of Fame that this would spawn. And I'm sure that there will be a Hall of Fame for Civ World. I'm not sure how that would be calculated. But, you know, in games of up to 200 people, I can imagine some nice things going on, I guess.
Are you kidding? It's a Facebook game. I mean, leaderboards are all... Every Facebook game has a leaderboard because that's how they hook you in, you know. You get an update with your friend bragging, hey, I scored 566. Try and beat that. And you say, oh, no, you don't. It's sort of like, you know, taunting you into playing more.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't know that there would be an in-game leaderboard, although that would be cool. I feel like, though, if like Civ Fanatics or other Civ communities decide to set up their own Hall of Fames, they would definitely probably ban, you know, doing anything like spending money or getting money by spending money at your grocery store.
I think fan sites like Civilization Fanatic Center and others ended up developing a leaderboard because there wasn't that ability provided by the developer and publishers of the game in the game or directly related to the game. Now, Civilization Revolution, for example, has a leaderboard that is not managed by the community, although there is to a certain extent managed by the community through the participation and the discussion and the coordination and the forums. I wouldn't be surprised if CivWorld stepped that up a little more and had that similar to what is going on with other Facebook games. Because the preview on IGN talks about how it redefines what's possible on Facebook while working within the confines of the platform. And I think, you know, as Jonah was saying, that that's a very strong draw for people with regards to the leaderboard. So I've got to believe that there's going to be some formal integration of that. And whether it's in-game, I mean, it's in-game, it's online, it's kind of all the same in there. And for those really techie people wanting to know, in the interview with Sid, he mentioned specifically that the game has been developed with Flash.
Oh, yeah.
Is that comparative to other Facebook games? I don't know.
Yeah, looking more at the specs for CivWorld, it seems more and more like SimCity 2000 Network Edition, in which people are trading their infrastructure. It seems like there's a lot of infrastructure in Civilization, you know, on Facebook, CivWorld.
I would like it if they did their own Hall of Fame thing as opposed to a community Hall of Fame. I certainly appreciate the community Hall of Fame work, but it helps. Like, one of the hardest things for the community to set up a Hall of Fame has been formation of rules that are agreeable to the participants. And that's something, like, one of the most annoying arguments is that whether or not the developers intended this or that. And certainly they could answer a lot of questions with that by making the rules themselves, what they intended us to do and did not intend for us to do.
I still think that a community Hall of Fame would still may still provide information that the in-house Hall of Fame might not. And yes, the rules would be kind of weird to navigate, but it would just be really weird and wrong to me if people could get ahead in the game and rise at the Hall of Fame just because they blew like $30 on Facebook credits.
Oh, absolutely. If Firaxis goes that route with the pay for doing well, then there's no choice. The community Hall of Fame will have to take over. There isn't any competitive balance when you're involving that sort of thing, unfortunately. So, yeah, that's the competitive balance should be one of the top priorities if you're talking about that kind of setting. And it has been, for the most part, in the Civ Fanatics Hall of Fame, at least. I don't know about the other Hall of Fames on other sites.
That's easily solved. All you do is have two separate Hall of Fames, you know? You could have one Hall of Fame in which it says no purchases made.
The people who...
who did make
purchases. Yeah, well...
They did that with Gauntlet, you know, way back when, you know, you had the high scores for people who just used the single quarter, and you had the high score... Actually, they would tell you how many quarters that person spent in order to get that score.
Nice.
So you'd have the high score for the guy who pumped a whole roll of quarters in.
So basically the guy who gives the most money to Firaxis is number one, and then it's number two donor to Firaxis, number three. I didn't know Firaxis was.
We could just divide their score by the amount of money they made.
There you go.
Yeah, the more money you spend, the worse your score. Hey. It'll be interesting to see with CivWorld, and Bam Bam has said in the chat, money can't buy happiness, but it can buy a CivWorld victory. It sounds like that's a possibility, but I've got to believe that Firaxis and 2K, for that matter, are looking at other Facebook games and the strengths and the weaknesses of both, kind of like, okay, we know that if we have this kind of system where more money equals better performance in the game, that there's going to be backlash for that, and they really want to take that on themselves. The only thing I really haven't talked about from the preview yet is kind of an indirect question. I mentioned how this basic fact sheet says that a game ends when one civilization wins the final age. And so then that begs the question to me, what are the victory conditions?
And the thing is that there's so much cooperation in CivWorld that you have to wonder, are they going to include, you know, if you ally yourself with someone, do you both win? That is an issue, I think, that's even more than the monetary issue, is that you have co-op play, and that is far more exploitable than just having someone plunk down $20 to get a civilization ahead.
Oh, yeah, there could be massive collusion going on here.
Well, you know, I mean, there's supposed to be an algorithm that calculates how much each person contributed to the team effort to decide what, and then the first person, you know, number one in the, I guess, in this whole coefficient of team usefulness is going to be the person who wins, quote unquote. So we'll see how that works out.
Lisa?
Yes?
Talking about algorithms and coefficients and such?
Yes.
That was so amazing. I love it when you do that.
I was so sure he was going to say that's hot.
He essentially did.
In a polite Canadian way.
We mentioned powerful units. That sounds like a segue.
Oh, here we go, folks.
Oh, man.
Oh, no. He's going to the top 10 list. No.
No top 10. What is... okay, so I called the top unique units, but I didn't put the number in there, so therefore...
So it's the top...
Close.
False positive. A false positive.
It's too close.
Right there, I'm calling this list a fix.
There, well, I see a nice little poll there for Dan. I understand now. Well, no, I don't. Well, I understood before. I understand even better.
Yeah, we're going to get to the poll. But this was a thread that was actually started by Seabury on the 2K forums last October. And on episode 114, you looked at the top unique units in the ancient, classical, and medieval eras for Civilization V. Minus those that you get from the downloadable content civs, which we, in between 114 and now in 118, we discussed our... We didn't talk about the best, we talked about our favorite downloadable content. I think that was an episode or two ago. Now, I'm actually going to backtrack a little bit. Rather than going, you know, from Renaissance forward, let's actually go in reverse order, simply because... Now, the modern era isn't covered on here. The modern era is, wow, mistake. I think everyone's favorite unit, even though it's not a unique unit, okay, in the future era is probably the giant death robot. That goes without saying. In the modern era, there is one unique unit, so I guess that means it is ranked number one by default?
The American
best
unit?
And worst.
Well, by default, you know, it's going to be a weak unit because by then, you know, a lot of stuff has been resolved. It's not going to be an overtop unit that can actually push you over victory. I mean, like a really unique unit might be like the Merv, in which you could nuke two cities at once or something like that, you know, but just having a slightly upgraded bomber.
Yeah, I always thought that they should make the later game unique units stronger than the base unit by more to compensate for the fact that they come late. Although I guess that would ruin advanced starts. But yeah, that's not something that's going to win you a game that you're otherwise losing. You're absolutely right, and that does cause problems. But could you imagine you get, like, it's twice the strength of other bombers or something? That might actually be useful.
They have the evasion promotion, which reduces damage taken from interception by 50%, and has the siege 1 promotion, which is plus 25 combat versus cities. So that's 60%. That's 60%. Wow, that's 60 combat goes to 75, and that's the difference between it and the bomber, which does not have these abilities, quote unquote. But it also the American B-17, which is the American bomber called the B-17. Okay, one and the same. It does also have a combat penalty versus naval units.
I think something that would heal a stack while you're fighting would be more useful in the late game, or not a stack. I mean. But healing nearby units, you know, while in enemy territory.
Yeah, I don't know. You can get things one-shotted so quickly. Or not one-shotted, but killed off within a single turn.
But then, you know, if you have like a fraction of your health left, a unit like that would be perfect.
Well, sure. If you're, I mean, I guess it would speed up your war, but it wouldn't make the difference between a win or a loss either. And that's always the problem with these late uniques, always.
Let's we'll backtrack here. Let's talk about the industrial era. Ooh, crazy. So we have, let's just name them here first. We've got the French Foreign Legion. We have the Japanese Zero and the German Panzer. So if I was to rank these, and you see it's not a top 10 because there are no 10. I'm going by era here, right? Rather than trying to do the whole game, which would just be... massively crazy, like the poll is massively crazy. But anyway, well, I'm sure we'll get to that. If I was to rank these, and if I would, and by if I mean I'm going to do that right now, in terms of general usefulness, I would put the Japanese 0 at 3, the German Panzer at 2, and the French Foreign Legion at number 1 in the industrial era as top unique units for non-downloadable content civs in Civ 5. There we go.
I would have the same thing, except I would put the Panzer first.
I can't say I've used either a lot, even though I've played as both civs.
But, yeah, I just like having a more powerful tank.
Is it more powerful or is it faster? I don't remember.
The Panzer is 20% stronger and 20% faster.
Huh.
It does have, like the other tanks, the other replaceable tank, I mean, it has no defensive bonuses and it has minus one hex visibility. And, of course, the penalty attacking cities. But the reason that I put the French Foreign Legion ahead of the German Panzer was because there's a 20 for the French Foreign Legion, there's a 20% combat boost outside of friendly territory, so that 36 combat becomes 43.
Hmm.
Plus, you don't have to worry about, oh, do I have oil or not for the German Panzer, which hopefully you do.
Yeah, I think I'd have to agree. The French Foreign Legion is pretty good, Dan, assuming you get there.
In the top 10, no, not top 10. It's not a top 10.
Thank you, Lisa.
My bad. No, I meant the poll that I was looking at, doesn't really seem to have a lot of industrial era or modern era units as favorites. I think by far the most popular units are, in the medieval or Renaissance era. Yeah.
Some of my favorites are in the ancient. I mean, because they give you a bonus right away, at least in Civ 4, because
I
remember
yeah,
the Jaguar Warrior was one of my favorite units.
Yeah, and of course the Axemen replacements are all pretty decent as well. I mean, I feel like in Civ 4, in Civ 5, unique units are at their most useful when they're at the earlier eras. I don't know if there's any way to really change that. I mean, yeah, you can give super bonuses, like Phil said, double the attack power of one unit, and that would make a difference in the modern era. But as far as unique units go, some civilizations are clearly disadvantaged by having unique units that occur later in the game.
The Japanese Zero, it replaces the fighter, yes, and its difference is that it has a bonus versus fighters. Otherwise, it's the same.
You do.
Well, I mean, the thing is, fighters already have an advantage over a bombers going against other fighters. But just in terms of general usability, I think a lot of your wars, even in that era, are going to be more land and naval based. But there's no naval unique units industrial era here.
You know what? One of the issues I have with specialized units is there's no all of these specialized units are combat units. It would have been nice if they had some non-combat specialized units.
Fast workers.
Well, not only that, but I mean, I could see maybe the Japanese getting a special unit that was better at fishing, with the fishing boats, and increasing your food output. That sort of stuff, would increase the strategy as well.
Well, it could be kind of a crapshoot depending on where you landed in. I mean, if you landed in the middle of a landmass as Japan, then you would be ultimately, you'd be ultra screwed.
I don't know if you'd be ultra screwed.
Non-combat.
Ultra screwed.
I don't know. It would just be kind of like your bonus is nullified, and therefore you're just normal. I mean, as normal as you can get in Civ.
But you see, that happens during the game anyway. So,
yes,
you had your Jaguar Warrior. Oh, guess what? He's nullified in the later rounds, and you're starting off nullified by getting the special bomber anyway.
I thought when you're talking about like non-combat unique units, I thought you're talking about like special settlers or something. Like, I don't know.
Well, they built two cities at once.
Like the settler with combat strength, so it doesn't die easily. That has definitely been suggested multiple times in the past.
That leaves us with the Renaissance, which there are 6 unique units for non-downloadable content civs for Civ 5. So this may actually generate some more discussion other than the other 2 later game eras in the game. But let's just talk about them, just give the titles first off. You've got the Russian Cossack replacing the cavalry. You've got the Ottoman Janissary replacing the musketmen. You have the American Minuteman replacing the musketmen. You have the French musketeer replacing, oh, look at that, the musketmen.
So is something replacing the musketmen here?
The English ship of the line, which is replaces the frigate. and the Ottoman Lancer replacement, the Sifa. I'm going to call it the C. That's its new name, S-I. Sure, Sai. I can't pronounce it properly. There we go.
Now, I don't have the stats in front of me, but is there any differences between the three advanced musketmen units, or they just have the same stats?
No, they do not have the same stats, and I'm so glad you asked that, Jonah, because I have the stats in front of me.
what were the odds?
Well, why don't I go ahead? I'll go from 6 to number 1, and then we can talk about them in any order that we want. Either because you want to rip me a new one from my list, or you just want to ignore it completely after I've said it, or somewhere in between. Number 6, the American Minutemen. Number 5, the French Musketeer. Number 4, the English Ship of the Line. Number 3, the Ottoman Sai. I'm cheating there, I know. Number 2, Ottoman Janissary. And number 1, the Russian Cossack.
The Russian Cossack is the one that goes real fast, right, and has a little bit of buffed power.
The difference between it and the cavalry that it replaces, military science, of course, requiring horses, is that it gets a 50% combat bonus against damaged enemy units.
I've always found that the cavalry was overpowered to begin with.
You mean awesome?
The cavalry is awesome, and so now this is just awesome with awesome sauce.
Extra sauce, yeah.
Awesome with extra awesome sauce.
There we go. That's what we're talking about.
Not the best against cities, but things will not stand against that in the field very effectively. Actually, all of these uniques are pretty good, all of them. And that makes it a little harder to rank than other eras where it's like, okay, well, you get the B-17. What are you going to do? Yeah, like the Janissary's ability where they heal after killing things is really strong too. And not only that, but they're stronger than normal, as I recall. So they really help out a civ that's otherwise terrible. And they are quite powerful.
Yeah, if it kills a non-barbarian unit, it heals instantly, and then when it's attacking, it gets a 25% combat bonus, so that 16 becomes 20. Jonah, you asked about the difference between here of all the different musketmen. So that's the difference of the Janissary from our standard musketmen. The American Minutemen, its difference is that it will ignore the terrain cost. So any rough ground, forest, hills, etc., they'll move as if it were flat, so one movement point per hex. That's the only difference.
The Sifai. That's Sifai. For the Ottomans.
Places the Lancer, which does not have the sight or pillage bonus. It gets the Sifai gets a one extra hex sight, and it has no movement cost to pillage. It also has one more movement per turn. It has 5 instead of 4. So that was at number 3. Yeah, there is, again, the penalty of attacking versus cities, but so often, especially to me in Civ 5, you want to, if not want to, then need to get rid of the units that are in on the hexes in your way. And once you get rid of them, these uniques are going to make it that much easier for you in that particular era.
Yes.
It's not a cakewalk, but it's just a matter of going through the motions after that, really. French Musketeer replaces the standard musketman. It's 25% greater combat strength. And then the English Ship of the Line, the frigate replacement, it's slightly cheaper. It's 107 hammers versus 120, which I'm kind of like, meh. But it has a slightly ranged combat improvement. It's 17 as opposed to 15, which I think is more significant, tying back into the strength of naval combat, especially seeing as how Navy works now with embarkation.
I love this little trivia item with the Ship of the Line. It says, the appearance is based on the British HMS Victory, which was ironically a 3 first rater and not a Ship of the Line.
Which one looked cooler? That's the question.
They probably chose it because it looked cooler, the HMS Victory. And also, it's a famous ship.
Yes.
Yeah, they do that kind of stuff in a lot of games. They'll call something one thing but show another.
But I guess we do have to talk about the poll because Lisa keeps going on and on about it for some reason. I don't know.
Oh, I know. You know how much I love polls, Dan. I know it's differently, but you just got to live with my preference.
What's leading the poll ever so slightly over the Japanese samurai is the Chinese Chokonu, followed by the Ottoman Janissary, the Roman Legion, and then the English Longbowmen, which we've also talked about. The others are all under 10 votes apiece, whereas these range from 17 to 25 votes. The two that do not have any votes for them at all, but this is such a contrast here for me with the Egyptian war chariot. When we consider what it was like in Civ 4, wow. And then somehow, kind of symbolically, the Japanese Zero has 0 votes.
What?
Said fuck what? Yeah, and the what. Okay.
Maybe speaking of what, we got mail.
Cats.
I actually got two pieces of email. The first from a Mark Lindstrom.
This email is from a person that's been playing Civ for a long time, since Civ 2. And he says that he started following you guys this season after hearing about the show, and I really enjoy it. Aww. He says that, as we've just discussed, this policy is lacking in Civ 5 and has some correlation to the AI being subpar. This is a long letter, so I'm not going to read all of it. But basically the gist of it is this part. One problem I have that I feel is a quick fix is when I'm in a leader meeting and they ask for a friendship agreement, war on a third party, or even open borders, I cannot go to the diplomacy page and see how this may affect my relationships with other leaders. Yes to this.
Yes.
That's true, and this is so annoying because you cannot evaluate, you know, what the effects of any of your choices will be. You'll just have to pick something. So this guy says, is there a mod for this? And do you find this to be a nuisance as well? Well, I think we know the answer to that last question. And then he decided to go to go propose a solution. So he says, if Firaxis implements the ability to see possible reactions to your diplomacy moves in leadership meetings through, let's say, an advisor, Secretary of State, then the accuracy of that knowledge can be attributed to your espionage/information gathering abilities. The more advanced you are in espionage, the more you know about the other Civ's feelings towards one another, which is kind of like what it was in Civ 4. So I would like to see secret agreements of friendship in addition to public. So you can be my friend, just don't tell anyone. And
didn't they have that already? I could have sworn that was. I'm not sure.
I think you're talking about the Pact of Secrecy, which is not exactly the same thing because it's against another Civ.
And they were removed.
And
yes.
So what do you guys think about this idea?
I don't like anything that requires extra investment when you like. It's a user interface issue. If you have the information available to you, you should be able to have it. You should be able to know it while the screen is coming up. It's ridiculous that you can't. Now, as for the espionage thing, I think that the only way that espionage could potentially contribute in this Diplo setting is the stuff that the right now the user interface doesn't show you. For example, the AI in Civ 5 is programmed to show friendly with you, and sometimes they're actually friendly, but sometimes they're actually plotting against you. And they're actually something else, but they'll still display friendly. And I think certain leaders are more XML biased towards doing that. So, yeah, certainly you could bring in an espionage element to mess with that as well as other things. But right now, honestly, the last thing Civ 5 needs is another mechanic to try to balance while they're trying to balance their current mechanics. Yeah, let's be frank. The espionage in Civ 4 was never completely balanced properly. And just to add another element like that into Civ 5 when they're just starting to get the single player, you know, looking a little bit more like it's starting to work and that it's getting closer to the point where it's a balanced game, I would not want to add something like that, which would just so drastically change it and could be so abusable. Oh, man. Espionage is, in really every iteration of Civ I've ever seen, espionage has been incredibly powerful when used to its potential.
Yeah, but I think his initial point about not being able to see the whole, diplomacy status while you're negotiating with a person is pretty germane. And I agree with that, espionage is the best way to go about it.
It just lets you view the Diplo screen while you have the window up. That's as hard as it would need to be.
Yeah, you don't need to have the espionage stuff. I don't think we need to add another mechanic. It just gets too complicated and it would... crashes. Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. Too soon. I mean, I do like this, but I think it's just having another advisor and adding the espionage is not really such a great idea. But I do love that. I do think it's a good point that the diplomacy is kind of messed up, and I really would like to be able to see what would happen if I did agree to, you know, take a pact of secrecy or whatever. Or not even that, just declare war.
I would have just liked it if they explained what the Pact of Secrecy was better.
They just removed it because it was nonsense.
It's like a 10-year-old thing. We're going to keep the secret. What are we
actually, they don't let you know what declarations of friendship do either. You have to look at the page on, I think it's on 2K actually, about the XML and how the AI treats it to actually figure out what the declaration of friendship is doing. It's so cryptic. There's no reason. Yeah, why not just let the players know the rules of the game?
Civ 5 as a whole was not very up on documentation.
By the way, Declaration of Friendship does add some, basically some disposition points towards you such that you can get away with more things as far as that AI is concerned while it's active. And one of the points to take away from that is that you want to stagger your declarations of friendship because you also get a bonus for having a mutual declaration friendship with a third civ. So if you have them both expire at the same time, you'll lose more diplo points than if you have them expire at different times, which again is a micromanagement issue that really annoys me because why should that be the case logically? But it is. So do stagger your declarations of friendship. And while they're active, you can get away with murder to some extent. Oh, and don't declare on a civ that you have a declaration of friendship with unless you want everyone in the world to know about it. The game will cheat. And the game will let civs that are on a different continent that never met you or the civ you killed know. They'll know that you declared on somebody you did a declaration of friendship with. Even if you wiped out your entire continent and there's no chance they could have known that. They'll know.
Wait a second. So even if you guys, even if there's only two of you on the same continent, your supposed friend, and you declare war on him, the other people in the continents will know?
Yeah, other people on other continents will know. Even if you total wipe him before they meet you, they will know.
They must have built the Oracle.
Must be it. I don't know. They unlocked the map pack wonder.
Mark asked about mods, and just to bring in a comment from Bam Bam on the chat, that there's an info mod that allows Diplo View.
Oh, interesting.
That was just kind of the only thing, I think, from the message that we hadn't addressed yet.
Alright, so should we move on to the other email? Oh my god, two! From Joel, or Colonel Mustard.
And who accuses Mrs. Scarlet of doing with a revolver in the conservatory.
I did not! Oh wait.
Candlesticks. Suppose you move up in difficulty, but find that next step too challenging at first. What are some game settings that you find are especially helpful in easing to the new difficulty? On the other hand, what are some of the game settings that you prefer to make a difficulty you're generally comfortable with a little more challenging?
Just as a preface here before we launch into it directly, I did respond to Joel by email before the show and noted that in our first season, in episode 14, we raised the question of moving up in difficulty level, but... the thing is, the fact that that was recorded prior to Civilization IV Beyond the Swords release, and of course Civilization V, I think it's a good time to revisit the topic. So we really actually can address this from a Civilization IV perspective, with Beyond the Sword now in our collective consideration, and also from Civilization V. So why don't we start with Civ IV?
Slower game speed. Play Marathon. Probably the one that'll make it easier by the most. Because first of all, Marathon flips the balance of units in Civ 4, but also everything happens faster by year, but you have more time to war in a given tech era, and that is where the AI is at its absolute worst. So you can basically war with impunity. You can even like take a 60-turn medieval war, and the AI won't get an era up on you, even on the highest levels. Which is something you just don't see on other speeds. It's impossible on other speeds to do that. You'll lose. You need to move faster. But on Marathon, you can get away with it.
Marathon. You said
Marathon.
Sorry, it sounded like Maritime. But could that be conversely used to make something more difficult if you decided to change your game speed to quick?
Yes.
Dan quick. Just kidding.
Yes. Playing on high levels. If you don't do a totally peaceful culture game on quick in Civ 4, quick is extremely difficult, and war against AI that can basically build the unit every single turn and will advance an era in 20 turns or something is just a nightmare. You have to plan for it so well and invade with a tech lead or really be on your game to succeed on high levels on quick. It is just ridiculous.
One thing that I also do is to play a civ that I find pretty easy for me. So for example, in Civ 4, some civs are, definitely a bit easier to play with. So sometimes I will play, for example, when I play Inca, I find that I can play almost a full level ahead of what my usual level is, just because of the you know, financial trade and the granary unique unit, which is
and
called
Jaguar.
The yeah. What is it called?
The Jaguar.
What, no, what was the granary? What was the granary called?
Terrace.
Yeah. The terraces. Yeah, those are nice. Especially
Jaguar
since you don't have...
is Aztec, actually.
Yeah, the... What's the Inca one? The Quechua. The Quechua.
Whatever. Yeah. However you pronounce it.
The Quechua. Whatever. Yeah, so I will do that. Just play a financial sieve just to make it easier for me. But it really depends on how you play and whether you are already well-versed in SE, which in my case wouldn't help you very much.
The other thing you can do is you can restrict the kind of victory conditions, you know, so that
yes,
because that if you it, just to get you started, so you can say turn off, I don't know, like the world domination, turn that off so that, you know, when another civ has gobbled up 2/3 of the rest of the world, you won't lose.
In Civ 4, the AI will almost never win domination. You will basically have three threats from the AI in a game of Beyond the Sword. The first threat is the AI just declaring on you and killing you. Okay, well, that can happen no matter what unless you enable Always Peace. Then you have Culture Wins, and that's probably the way the AI will win the fastest if left unchecked, although they tend to be weaker than other civilizations, so you can attack them and take them out, unless they piece vassal to somebody or just massive civs that go culture, which happens sometimes. And then finally, if you're falling behind in tech and can't intercept them in time, they can win space on you. Those are really the only ways, aside from like really, you know, rare and kind of cheap Apostolic Palace, you know, just happens to spread the right way. But those are the only three ways you're going to lose in a game of Civ 4 on high levels, pretty much ever. I mean, I've probably played well over 100 games, maybe 200 games at this point. I can't remember a time I lost to something other than one of those three things.
The main point was just turn off some of the victory conditions.
Yeah, turn off culture. Definitely turn off culture. Consider turning off space, because then you essentially have forever. You can stay in the game until you either die or you kill everybody else. And that's certainly a way to learn the game, too. And
yeah, doesn't the game end in 2050 no matter what? Or you can just play on.
Turn off time.
Turn off time. I forgot. You can lose time if you disable all the other victory conditions with that one on high levels. That's true. So yeah, just leave the military victories on. There you go.
Actually, can you just disable all victory conditions?
Well, then you can't win.
Then you can't. Well, no one loses, but no one can win either.
It's true.
Unless they wipe you out, you know.
But you can still lose.
That's the ultimate lose condition. Forget all the other stuff. They just come and just killer stack you to death and boom.
But yeah, disabling culture, I think more so than any of the other victory conditions, disabling culture will make the game a bit easier.
But the funniest thing is that's the way I win the most, is by a cultural victory.
It's an effective victory condition, but when the AI gets on, if you're talking about a high level AI screwing you over, you know, you're talking about like late 1700s, early 1800s culture wins or something, or maybe even a little bit earlier than that.
Oh, by the way, but I mean cultural victory. I mean in Civ 4. Civ 5, it's tougher than tough for me to win a cultural victory.
Yeah, I'm still talking about Civ 4. Civ 5's culture is a little different. You can get it pretty quickly. I've seen how other people do it. It's not appealing to me because it's not a fun way to play the game for me.
But there you go. If you want to increase your difficulty in Civ 5, try to win a cultural victory.
Yeah, I just don't like having just to have like two or three cities just so that I can, you know, so that I don't have the, what do they call it? You know, the
Civ
waste.
Cost.
Yeah, I mean, you have to keep your city number small so that you focus your culture and all that stuff. I like being spread out. Damn it.
Yeah, a lot of the fast culture wins involve a single city and gaming the system to keep up in tech and getting to certain wonders and social policies as soon as you can, reducing the cost of future social policies. And then that really speeds up the rate at which you can pick them up. And after that, it just becomes a matter of survival in Civ 5.
Yeah, but see, that's what I said earlier in this podcast was the reason why I turned off Civ 5 was that it was so, you know, it was forcing you down certain avenues when in Civ 4 I felt like, okay, this isn't working, so I guess I could switch to this strategy.
I would say in Civilization 5, to some extent in Civ 4 as well, something that you can do, yeah, I think it's even more in Civ 5 because you're dealing with Carpets of Doom and Empire instead of Stack of Doom, is on some map types, you have to look at this, on some map types, you can modify just how plentiful resources are. And that covers, of course, not only your luxury resources, but also your strategic resources, which can be a way, again, back to Joe's original email, when I'm half in stereo there, very faintly.
Well, I find that if you choose continents, you know, you can keep restarting until you're sure that you're not near any civil. You're sort of remote so that you have room to grow and just, you know, do your own thing while the other civs are whacking each other on another continent.
That gets really bad if they whack each other successfully. I've had some bad experiences.
Or archipelago, so you turn it into a naval game.
Yeah, that's where the AI is really awful. That would certainly make a game easier. In both Civ 4 and Civ 5, running Archipelago will make the game easier.
Yeah, and if you're choosing a game like Continents, for example, then it's going to take longer for you to be able to find out where the other AI is. Where the other AI is. I'm not calling you an AI. Whoops. To find out where the AI is. Find out where the AI is and to actually do something about it.
Yeah.
Other than, you know, rage quit.
Yeah, it's not fun to meet one of those AIs with, like, 30 cities that's killed two civs and it's just, you know, it's like an arrow or two in front of you.
The only normal human player.
There's even just look, I think, even their gold income and how much money they're making a turn. It's like, oh, look at that, they've got, like, 4,000 or 5,000 gold, and look at that, they're making a couple hundred gold a turn. Uh-huh. Yeah. Other ways that you can increase the difficulty... Actually, not just in Civ 5, but also in Civ 4. Turn on Raging Barbarians.
Oh, yeah.
That will do it. That will certainly make it harder.
Well, you can also turn on Aggressive AI. That definitely makes it a lot harder. I think we once played a Aggressive AI game on Emperor, and one person commented that it was harder than Deity.
What Aggressive AI does is make it more volatile. If you survive the early game, you'll basically win because Aggressive AI suck at attacking really badly, even on high levels. They're awful. But if you don't, then you're in trouble. Now, I think part of the problem we had in that game is we went like Emperor with quick game speed Aggressive AI. So they just kept making units, and we couldn't do anything about it because of the quick game speed. And we had, I think, not enough civs on the map. So the civilizations got bigger, too. And that's another way to make a game harder. Reduce the number of civs that are on the proper map, because the AI can pay for the cities more easily than you, and it will out-expand you then, and that'll give you more of a challenge. You can make games unwinnable that way.
I found the opposite sometimes with Raging Barbarians, because on medium game levels, especially if you build a great wall, I found that the Raging Barbarians turned into mind worms that attacked other civilizations because they couldn't handle them as well as you could.
Yes, that's assuming you can make it. That's true. The Great Wall will make Raging Barbarians an easier setting rather than a harder one. But once you start getting Emperor Plus, there's a good chance you're going to die before you can finish the Great Wall. It's pretty incredible. They are on you, and they are on you very hard.
You can also disable the Goody Huts in Civ 4 or the Ruins in Civ 5 to increase your difficulty.
I think that's more of a wash. I don't know that it really changes difficulty all that much. I do hate them, though, and we'll disable them as a rule because... This is a strategy game, not a luck game. We're not playing war, we are playing Civ.
It's impacting your early oomph.
Yeah, I think the early bonuses in the game from scouting can really help, especially in Civ 5. I mean, we just spent, like, you know, a segment in the last episode talking about the advantages of scouting. So when you eliminate ruins and, you know, goody huts, you take away that advantage significantly.
But you also take it away from more civilizations than your own. And those civilizations, they have more units to scout than you.
Yes. Okay. I see your point.
I would say it's more of an impact in Civ 5 than it is in Civ 4, getting rid of the ruins than the good units.
I think you're right about that. I think you're right. I think ruins are a little stronger than lucky huts.
Yeah.
It's not going to apply to the whole game either, of course, but just kind of that those early circumstantial things.
Playing games where you put restrictions on yourself outside of the in the game but outside of the options in the game can also be fun. For example, you know, playing a game where you tell yourself you have to you can't have a slider on or something, you know, after a certain time. Well, that was Julian Assange, wasn't it? Okay, the Julian Assange, let's play, the Julian Assange Mad Scientist RPG game had a feature where you could not have, you have to turn the slider off at Alphabet and just work on Espionage and Gold, basically. So, you know, that sort of challenge can be fun. I think I think Mad Scientist would be good for that, you know, his RPGs, just in terms of getting the most out of the skill level that you're playing at the moment.
That's true. When you make up rules like that, you can certainly change the difficulty too.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
You can Skype us at The Polycast or email us at thepolycast@gmail.com.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast and Revcast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
There was one feature that was mentioned that's coming into the next Civ 5 patch, and they have announced that they're going to be including hot seat play.
Yes, that's a big one, and a lot of people are excited for that one. I want to see the current multiplayer work too, but yeah, whatever. Adding hot seat, definitely useful.
Which begs the question, where's play by email? If you can stretch out those games like that, let's have play by email. You know? Oh, I'm on turn 100 and 2 years later.
Yeah, pretty much.
I think we should have the next innovation, play by instant message.
I mean, I am disappointed that this patch doesn't include the replay like everybody thought last episode.
Replay would be nice. I don't think it's a priority right now, but it would be nice to have it. I don't have anyone around the house that actually plays Civ, so I can't really make use of it unless I want to play with myself, which has some implications that I don't enjoy. But... I'm just talking about playing a game here. I don't know why you guys are getting so worked up. And I don't need to be getting rises out of everyone.
Well, actually, you know what? A lot of the excitement came from the fact that these gamers were saying, hey, I'll finally be able to play with my non-gamer wife. So it sounds like it's a way for people to engage people who don't know Civ or aren't really into video games. Like, okay, you can play, and it's not hot seat. They're actually just sitting together, and okay, it's your turn. This is what you can do.
Unless they expressed interest in playing the game prior to you sitting them down to the hot seat, I wouldn't hold my breath. I'm just saying.
I mean, they may just see you sitting there for hours and wondering, what the heck is the big deal? Why is he sitting there for hours, and why is he 3 hours late for dinner? You know, I gotta see what's going on with that.
Sounds like the basis for a new eHarmony or Match.com.
You must be at least Monarch level.
It's been a great time at Polycast number 800.
No. Whoa, hey now, Lisa.
Wow, I've been on Polycast a lot longer than I thought. Okay, it's been great joining you guys today for Polycast 118. That's what I mean. And we have been joined here by our guest co-host, Jonah Falcon.
Hello, or goodbye.
Our regular co-host, Dan Quick.
I am the greatest unique unit.
Ooh. Mackie.
So, I can't do it. I'm going to go for Jiffy before I say something terrible.
I can't do it. I can't do it. That's her ending. That's the last sentence we'll ever hear from Mackie. And the me and team.
I can. I will show you guys my favorite unique unit later.
Ooh. Do we have to bring $1 bills?
$1 bills. I demand toonies. I want Canadian toonies only.
Loonies.
No, toonies. I want the toonies.
And I'm also on this Polycast too, I think. All right.
That's a very existential statement there.
All right. Have a good day, everybody. Or a bad one, if that's what you feel like.
I recommend good days based on personal experience.
Have a day that you like. Whether it's good or bad.
All right, so we're going to be starting with Civ World, preview with a basics.
Hello.
Ah.
Hey.
We are experiencing more technical difficulty. I don't know if the listeners can hear Dan. I cannot. Can you guys hear Dan?
No, I cannot.
Oh, just watch it come out and be like a buggy piece of something. Piece of something. Buggy piece of something.
Piece of pie. Hey, there we go.
Hey, yeah. There we go.
That's what
piece
I meant.
Piece of 3.14159.
1.56. They had to slice the pie.
I see.
Record day, May 14th, 2011. Civilization 4 and Civilization 5 sound clips, copyright Take 2 Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.